Yeah, thanks a lot for the invitation. It's really fun to be here and a pleasure. And you know, so okay, LGT is Lattice Gauge Theories, and that's a good thing to start with, right? So you guys really have to let me know where I should provide more explanations and where I'm too slow, too fast, whatever. Yeah, so it's you know, the goal of the talk is to give you guys a little bit of an overview and a feeling for where this field stands. The goal is to quantum simulate, as the title says, lattice gauge theories, and I'm going to talk about Z2 lattice gauge theories as a simple example, but there are others too. And okay, dynamical matter, we'll also discuss what that means. Right, but it's so you'll see many, you know, cold atom type of setups and Rydberg tweezer setups, and the idea is really to give you guys a feeling of where the field stands. I don't want to bore you with details, so if you, you know, tell me when to skip, basically. Yeah, and so of course, as always, there's many people involved. Annabelle is here. She, you know, she was also part of some of the projects here, and I want to emphasize in particular these two guys, Jad Halime, a postdoc of mine, and Lucas Ohmeyer, a PhD student who did lots of the work that I'm going to show you. And the first part is in a collaboration with Monika Eidelsberger's group, actually. And okay, we'll get there. Yeah. So what's all of this about, right? So I want to talk about gauge theories and matter. And one, you know, there are many ways this show up, but one way this shows up is in the context of the fractional quantum Hall effect that you may have heard at some point. And the idea is, you know, you have matter, let's see these psi fields, let's say bosons or fermions, and they move around. And when they move around, you see their kinetic energy here is coupled to this gauge field, right? This vector potential A. I can describe it. You have other things like interactions and Trebe effects. They're very important, of course, but that's the idea. And so this is something, you know, we all learn in grad school or before, that, you know, matter, when it moves around, it can couple to gauge fields, and these A operators, it's important to understand them, right? And of course, the next logical step is to ask what happens when you put a head onto these, onto these A fields and make them quantum mechanical themselves, right? And that essentially gives you a quantized theory of the gauge fields. And the simplest example of doing this is the Z2 lattice gauge theories, right? Or one of the simplest. And that's what I want to talk about here, and how to realize this in an actual quantum system, right? And so you can see some of the same elements, and you know, we'll discuss this more later. But here you have these A particles, that's the same as these psi fields here. And I'm on a lattice, ij are sites now, right? And what's going to happen is that the particles A, they hop from A to J on nearest neighbor sites, right? And when they hop in between, you have this tau z variable, that's essentially the A that got ahead, okay, right? So this is the hopping, that's kinetic energy, and when it hops around, it sort of, you know, lets the gauge field know that something is going on. And then you have, these are free gauge terms, essentially like E squared plus B squared terms boiled down to Z2. So that's what we're going to talk about. And part of the motivation for me to study this is that such type of theories, you know, have been showing up in the context of phenomenological descriptions of high, strongly correlated materials, such as high temperature superconductors, right? And so I believe it's pretty unclear if there's a one-to-one correspondence. You know, we don't think that high TC is simply a Z2 lattice gauge theory. That's certainly not what people believe. But you know, it's known that some of the phenomenology of these lattice gauge theories combined with matter, like we have it here, right? This matter here couples to these gauge fields. That seems to match some of the exotic physics that shows up in high TC. Okay, that's part of the motivation to say, you know, these theories are complicated. We want to quantum simulate them.
Yeah. Can I ask you here, is this a Z2 gauge theory or is the low energy physics a gauge theory? So this, the last term in your Hamiltonian, is it imposing constraints?
This one here?
Yeah.
So this would be the Plaquette term, like the magnetic field term. And here I'm always assuming it's an actual gauge theory. So I assume that this is supplemented with an extra Gauss law.
Okay. And this commutator that you have below, is that what you mean?
Yeah, right. So this Hamiltonian here, I'll get to more details on, but you know, it commutes with these GJs. These are local conservation laws. Essentially, you have all, at each side, you have a separate conservation law of this type. And you can check that this line satisfies this. Wow. And in addition.
But you didn't define G, but that's
right. This is our gauge condition. Yeah. And you know, I'll actually define it later on. Yeah, more questions? Right, and so just to get you the bigger picture, right? Of course, Z2 is one thing you can do. Another thing is people think about is how to go to quantum electrodynamics. That's a U1 gauge theory. Put that on a lattice. There are ways. So you know, when you do quantum simulation, you want to boil down the real world to something simpler. One point is you have to go to the lattice. So you have to discretize things. You want to put things on qubits, right? You can't have infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. And these quantum link models are one way. And you can see here, these are all spin 1/2. You have again, these metaparticles psi here, now it's a pair, you know, annihilation term, and then there's this spin plus term here. That's one way to do a U1 gauge theory, right? Looks kind of similar as before, except that now here we have this S plus instead of the SC, right, that I had on the Z2. And this makes a big difference for the gauge group, okay? But and then, of course, a longer term goal that we're also thinking about is how can you implement you know, things like SU2, SU3 non-abelian gauge theories in an actual quantum simulator, and with the ultimate goal to simulate you know, QCD. And that's a long shot goal, obviously, right? But I think some of the tools that I want to walk you through now in the rest of the talk also, we believe we started to apply them to things like SU2, and we think they are useful to, you know, to build actual quantum simulators that can hopefully one day get us, you know, some understanding, some more understanding of these phase diagrams. Okay.
Yeah, I'm always curious that, is it possible to simulate a continuum field theory? You know, the limit model is not a continuum field theory, and you cannot push it to the continuum limit at all. So then, what's the motivation to really use those models to simulate?
Well, why do you? I mean, I think in some low energy limits, they should also have some continuum description.
The definition of continuum field theory is that you start with a Gaussian.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you turn gauge coupling.
Yeah.
And gauge coupling is always infinitesimal.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
yeah.
the definition of right. continuum field theory.
Yes.
But in those quantum wave models,
right.
you don't have a direct control on the gauge coupling. It's always all the one.
Yeah.
So it's a very non-trivial question. So
right, but
the continuum field theory.
Right. That's true. But I guess if you if I take the large S representation of these guys, you have a large S classical limit, and I think then you should.
It's pretty challenging, I think. There's some progress by Sherry and his supervisor. They find a way to simulate the CP1 model in the continuum limit. It's still a mystery that why that works.
But so are you saying that it's hard to actually fully get the field theory, or are you saying these guys don't have low energy effective field theory description?
Those models will correspond to theory at order one coupling constant.
Oh, so you want to tune the coupling strength.
For field theories, they care about the theory with infinitesimal gauge coupling. That's the definition of continuum field theory.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the real problem they care about.
Mm-hmm. Right. So to be honest, I never think about this last step going to the continuum limit, to be honest. But I would also, so in that sense, I guess you can turn around and say that what these systems should do is simulate strongly coupled theories, which are even harder, I guess, right?
Yeah. It's even harder.
Yeah.
To field theorists,
yeah.
It's not going to define theory at all.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's
not really reliable. We condense matter, we don't care.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. No, I agree. I think it's actually a funny thing how this shows up. So people ask me, what's a lattice gauge theory? In a field theory, there's a well-defined prescription what gauge means and so on, right? But once you go on a lattice, you know, here, of course, you have these local conservation laws. But what makes a local conservation law a gauge law, right? It's very arbitrary, I think. Right. So I think that's maybe also one other aspect how this same kind of problem shows up, that it's really a different set of theories, right?
Yeah.
Okay. More comments or questions? All right, so this is kind of the overview of where we want to head. And I don't know how familiar you guys are with Z2 lattice gauge theories in particular, so I just maybe want to give you the bare definitions of what they are, right, for the rest of the talk. So I mean, I sort of told you the players will be on the links. We have qubits, let's call them tau z, right? You can flip them with tau x operators, right? In this lattice gauge community, tau z is usually the measurement basis in qubits. Here it's kind of the other way around. So think of tau x as the measurement basis. And then on the sides, we also have qubits, and these we call A. That's the meta. These are just hardcore bosons. And so they can also be empty occupied. And then we have this Z2 Gauss law here that came up before. And this is sort of the conservation law that we want to impose on everything. And there's one condition that the Hamiltonian should commute with with all of these GJs at each side. And the GJ itself is, this is now specific for the Z2 lattice gauge theory. It's defined in this way. So it's the parity of your meta on a given site, let's say J. And there's a product of all incoming tau x fields. And tau x, think of those as the electric strings. Okay. So if you think about the Gauss law in electrodynamics, you have charges and the electric field strings go out. The Gauss law tells you how much charge there is, tells you how many field lines go out. And that's exactly what's happening just on a Z2 level, right? So if you if you simultaneously diagonalize your Hamiltonian and these constraints, which you can do because of this commutation, you impose this eigenvalue condition. That's the Gauss law, and all it tells you is that these are the only allowed configurations. So you basically have a constraint on your Hilbert space, and it tells you if there's a Z2 charge, like one of these hardcore bosons sitting there, a string has to end right coming in either from the left or the right, or if there's no Z2 charge, like here, the string can either go through or there's no string at all. And these are the only allowed configurations. And things like, if there would be a string coming in here ending and there would not be a matter particle, those we want to disallow. And, they're not in, they're formally inside the Hilbert space, but we don't want to have them in our low energy Hilbert space, essentially. Okay? And then you can ask what types of Hamiltonians can you cook up that satisfy this Gauss law? And this is kind of the, these are the generic terms you can cook up. There are more, of course, but this first one is the C2 minimal coupling that I told you about. So it's basically a matter particle hopping around, and when it hops around, the tau z, what it does, it flips the string, right? The string is defined in the x basis, so it flips it, so that means it moves and drags the string along. That's the first line. The second line is just a kind of a confining field. It tells you that the length of your, the longer your string, the more energy you pay for the string, right? That's just the tau x variables. And then the third line only exists in 2D or ladder type settings, right? These plaquette terms, and in the toric code, you've probably seen them. So they basically take a whole plaquette and flip all the strings around. And you can see that if you have nothing and you flip all the strings, you essentially create a loop, right? So it also doesn't create any endings. Therefore, it's gauge invariant, right? And this will show up in these quantum simulation setup. These terms, they're not very common in field theories or in, any lattice theory that you would derive directly from the field theories, but they're also gauge invariants, like meta-meta terms, or you can really have any combination of densities of the particles and these tau x electric field terms, right? Anything clearly commutes with this Gauss law. So that's kind of the toolbox from which we draw. Okay, good. So these terms will show up. And now, more specifically, the goal I have in mind is I want to simulate one of the very first models that people have studied to look at this whole phenomenon of confinement that shows up in quark physics clearly, right? And this is really this model by Fredkin and Schenker, and they studied a Z2 version of a field theory at Z2 matter and Z2 gauge fields, and we'll discuss in more detail what this means precisely. And they basically came up with this type of phase diagram. It has two interesting axes. One is a pure gauge theory axis on here. And this is essentially what you would now call perturbed toric code. So all the way here in this corner, this is when you just have these plaquette terms and you also impose the Gauss law. That's exactly the toric code point. This free charge region here that they kind of anticipated should show up, that's what we now call toric code topological ordered phase. Here on this left side, this is like a confining phase, which is very trivial. It has a very simple product eigenstate, and there's no topological order. And then here, this axis is a pure gauge axis. So you just have a Z2 theory for your matter part, and that's nothing but a 2 plus 1 de-Ising model with an Ising critical point that's here. And so this upper part here sort of corresponds to the long-range ordered phase, like an Ising ferromagnet, if you wish. And down here, it's a paramagnet that doesn't have any order. And these guys looked at what happens if you now couple them in a Z2 gauge invariant way. And the amazing thing is that this long-range ordered phase here, what order means really kind of loses its meaning because of the gauge coupling. And then they showed that inside this region out down here, they basically mathematically proved that there's no phase transition, that the free energy is completely continuous. That means this phase here is exactly the same as this confining phase here. And so this is kind of the starting point. It shows you that if you add matter to a theory, you really expect essentially these two phases, nothing more. Which is because another scenario would have been that there would be a line going all the way into the corner here, and that you could have maybe had three phases, but they mathematically showed that that's not the case. And so a natural goal is to realize something like this in a quantum simulator, right? And but when we design things, we you can actually come up with versions of it. So Fredkin Schenker looked at a case where the matter field had a Z2 symmetry. So what we find is you can get a quantum version of this. So what I mean with this is there are additional terms that make it impossible to map this model that we simulate to a classical field theory, which you can do in a Fredkin-Schenker limit. So Fredkin-Schenker really gives you a classical, you know, higher dimensional gauge theory. And you can also extend the size of your gauge group and have matter that has a global U1 symmetry instead of the global Z2 symmetry. And then, you know, also get some, you know, slightly different physics. And again, the motivation is to study effective theories of condensed matter. And theories like these, you know, came up again in high TCE context, for example. OK, so I hope this gives you an idea of what we're aiming for. Any questions? OK. Good. So now, you know, the way we want to look at this is from a quantum simulation point of view. So the idea is, in, you know, we want to study these theories not from, let's say, a field theory point of view, which is also interesting, and which is, you know, we ultimately want to connect to, but from a quantum simulation point of view. And all these quantum simulation setups, what they do is, you know, essentially they take you snapshots, they give you data. You know, I know your group, you know, loves data, and then you can analyze it. You can look at higher order correlations, non-local order parameters. And these are all things on, you know, dynamical probes, for example. These are all things that are not so easily accessible in field theories, I would say, right? And that overall have not been explored too much, I would say. So these quantum simulations really provide a new perspective on this. And one example is this confinement problem, of course, right? So and that's also even true actually in this Fredkin-Schenker diagram here. So on this axis, it's very easy to say what it means to be confining and non-confining. Once you go inside here and have dynamical matter, there are no simple order parameters. You know, you can come up with some, but they're kind of very convoluted. And so one natural motivation is to find simpler order parameters based on these snapshots that immediately tell you whether it's confining or not. Mm-hmm.
Is this a ground state phase diagram, the one you have?
Fredkin-Schenker?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ground state.
Yes.
So we will need to get to the ground state first, right?
Yes. Yeah. That's also a problem, of course. For the quantum simulation, yes. But there are also, of course, dynamical phenomena that you can explore in these models. And again, there's, you know, very little is known about that.
I would say. Maybe relate to that phase diagram, but that phase diagram is strictly speaking.
Yes. Right, exactly. Yes, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. More questions? Okay, good. And so as I said, the type of setups I want to, you know, look at is superconducting qubits, cold atoms, or tweezer arrays, actually. They're very powerful, of course. All right. And okay, so as I said, I want to give you an idea of, you know, where the field stands. And so, you know, different people and try different approaches. And one way to approach this is what I would call bottom-up approach, right? So at the end of my postdoc, I started playing around with this. And we were kind of naive and saying, well, let's just put, you know, some terms together such that the effective Hamiltonian that your physical system realizes has this Z2 Gauss law, right? That it, you know, basically you want to go and design these very specific terms, namely this Z2 minimal coupling here and also this confining term. And you just want to ask, how can I get, let's say, cold atoms in a lattice to have, you know, to be described by exactly this Hamiltonian? We'll get to the shortcomings of this later, but you know, set out and ask how can we achieve this? And so what this means really is kind of simple. You have a nearest neighbor hopping, let's say, between some sites J1 and J2, but the you know, the phase of this hopping here should depend on some qubit, right? So we need some qubit that tells us whether the hopping has a plus or a minus sign, right? And that, you know, it changes the kinetic energy a lot, right? Because it, you know, if it's plus, you want to have the anti-symmetrized or a symmetrized orbit, and if it's a minus, the opposite one, right? And so before I tell you how to do it, let me go one step back and ask, let's fix the tau z, right? Let's say we just want to externally control whether this hopping is a plus or a minus. And people studied this a lot in this context when they looked at realizing synthetic gauge fields for neutral atoms, right? They also wanted to imprint phases. And the way, well, one of the most successful ways to do this is this scheme by Yaksh and Zoller. The idea is kind of simple. Imagine you just have these two sites, and you have a particle, and you let it hop around back and forth. That just gives you the dagger A tunneling term, right? And first thing you do is you actually switch on a very big gradient, delta A, which is much bigger than the hopping. And what it does, it really switches off the tunneling, right? Because the energy barrier is so high that it's very unlikely to tunnel. But then you go and you switch the tunneling back on. The way you do that is you actually modulate this gradient here by some, you know, amplitude V omega and some frequency omega. And you make sure this omega is actually resonant with your detuning. So that's the condition here on the right, that this gradient is, you know, also n times the frequency of your shaking. And that means you shake the system, you give it, you just make this hopping resonant again, but it gives you 1 degree of freedom, which is the phase with which you modulate, right? So if you can modulate with any particular phase. And if you then derive the effective Hamiltonian, the cool thing is that you do get an effective hopping Hamiltonian between 1 and 2, except that the hopping has a phase e to the I n times phi, and phi is exactly the phase of your drive. Okay? And so this is, you know, a very simple way of making use of this phase degree of freedom here. There's another thing that happens, which is that the amplitude of your restored tunneling is renormalized by some Bessel function. Okay, that's you do some Floquet theory and you can derive this. Now, usually we don't care so much about the Bessel function. It just rescales your tunneling, right? It just gives you, instead of T, it gives you some T tilde, right? But we'll see in a minute that we can now actually make use of this Bessel function and to, with this guy, basically control the sign of your hopping by some, atomic degree of freedom. And the way this works is kind of simple. Instead of using a gradient to switch off the tunneling, we're just going to use a Hubbard interaction to achieve this, right? So imagine you have two types of atoms now, the A, that's the matter, and this F for this gauge field. And they have a strong Hubbard interaction U, right? Now, let's freeze the F for a moment, right? The F is just sitting there. Then, from the point of view of the A particle, this is exactly like this tilted double well before, right? Except that the tilde is now given by this Hubbard U, right? You know, if as long as the F particle is not moving, that's all it does. And then, of course, we want the same condition again, that this U, that's the gradient, is some multiple of the driving frequency when once we restore it, right? And now, of course, the thing gets more interesting once you allow the F particle to move around, because then you can either have the gradient go from left to right up or the other way around, right? So that the A particle is either hopping up onto the F or hopping down from the F. Okay, and the bottom line of this is if you basically, if you look at this so far, the A and F, they look like they're the same thing, right? They, because both see this Hubbard U, but they should be different. And the way to achieve this is by just having a, in addition, these gradients that I discussed before, but have them be seen only by the F particle, say. So there's a state-dependent lattice. The F particles see this additional gradient, the A's don't. And then the combination of all of these gives you a Hamiltonian very general like this. And all I'm saying here is that the A particles hop and they have an effective phase that they pick up, which only depends on the density of your F particles. Okay? So the density of one component controls the phases of the hopping for the other. These are all details. And this is, in the end, how the experiment in Monika Eidel's book, Burger's group, also looked like. So the idea is if the F particle is on the right, we call this a tau z equals plus 1 qubit state. Okay, and then you can see that the A particle is hopping onto this gradient. And we said the modulation now is, well, it gives you T times Bessel function 1 of this driving strength. But if the F particle is sitting on the left, the A particle is hopping down. And if you hop down, you get this minus chi here, because the input of the Bessel function had the drive amplitude there. And essentially, you switch omega to minus omega now. That gives you this change of sign. And if the F is on the left, you basically call it the tau z equals minus 1 state. And then, long story short, it means that when the A particle is tunneling, you essentially exactly got this minimal coupling term, right? You get an A dagger A times tau z, where the tau z just tells you whether your F particle is on the left or on the right. And then you look at the F particle. And there the trick is that the F particle, in addition, it also sees the gradient. Only the F particle sees it. And that means, it's almost the same, except when the F particle hops onto the A, it sees the Hubbard U plus or minus the gradient. And that means if we choose the Bessel function 0 and the Bessel function 2 to be equal, we don't pick up this extra minus sign. So the upshot is, by playing around with these Bessel functions and fine-tuning to one specific point, you can exactly implement this Hamiltonian, right? So if you zoom out a little bit, forget all the details, I'm basically saying if you combine Floquet engineering with lots of fine-tuning, you essentially get a model that looks exactly as you want and has this Gauss law built into it, right?
So if the fine-tuning is not perfect, do I break the gauge invariant?
Yes. Yeah, I'll get to that in a second. And that's exactly right. The question, you should worry about this, right? Exactly. So let's look at the experiment for now that they did. They did this, optical lattice. the experiment doesn't even exist anymore. It's, I think, Immanuel Bloch's very first experiment. And this was the last experiment they, you know, did on this machine before they disassembled it. And so they, for example, they didn't have full single site resolution yet, right? This is, they really averaged over many things. So it's not as clean as we would hope for. But the upshot is, let's start with this, right? So they basically created this state here, which is a gauge invariant initial state. The F particle is delocalized, the A particle is on the left. They let the A particle move, and ideally you would expect this gray curve, so the matter should oscillate back and forth. The experiment sees this, right? You can see it's clearly somewhat washed out.
Sorry. Yeah. I don't know what this plot, can you explain what this plot is showing?
Right, so this is time, and Q1 is basically the density of your A particle on the left side.
The A particle was the matter or the gauge?
Yeah, the matter, yeah. Right, so it's basically just telling you how the matter is hopping back and forth. Right. Yeah, and so you can, you know, you induce some dynamics. We also looked at this one. That's the tau z expectation value. So tau z is a, you know, that's the gauge field itself. And the gauge field itself should never have any dynamics, right? It's a non-measurable quantity. Of course, in the quantum simulator, you can measure it, right? But then because of gauge invariant, it should be strictly zero. Now, experimentally, it's not strictly zero, right? You can see some noise here, some oscillations, that also some systematics, let's say, that go beyond noise. It's clearly, you know, the dynamics here is less pronounced than here. So here we can clearly see some, you know, large amplitude happening. And the reason is exactly what Yinchen was asking, right? The system is not completely homogeneous, so we don't hit the completely right fine-tuning point in some cases. And that means it's not perfectly gauge invariant, and that means things like the tau z here can actually get some finite expectation values. And these background simulations here give you an idea, you know, that's a simulation of the more realistic parameters, including the gauge symmetry breaking, and then we expect exactly this level of noise, essentially, right? All right, so, you know, clearly this is just a demonstration. You can have a building block with the Z2-lattice gauge theory and start doing experiments. So let's ask how serious do we have to care about the fine-tuning, right? And again, okay, so this is time. And what I'm plotting in the color code is the expectation value of your Gauss law on site one. And ideally, it should be complete, you know, exactly equal to minus one. So if it's dark, that means you satisfy the Gauss law. You want it to be satisfied for all times. That's actually true on this line here. So the y-axis, that's our frequency with that we drive, right? And this is theory simulations, right? So we, you know, the theory, you just look at this, and you can see that if you're slightly above omega equals u, which omega equals u is what we from the simple Fourier theory expect, we're slightly above this, we get gauge invariant, you know, satisfied to very long times. So the good news is, if you really fine tune, you'll find a spot where gauge invariance is truly restored for a long time. But of course, if you look at this more critically, you would say, well, these red lines, you know, they're really bad, right? If you go off a little bit here, this is some not even 10%, more like 2-3%. You know, you hit these regions where you violate the Gauss law really seriously, right? So that's very bad news, and it's you know. I guess it shows that the plot before, this simple experiment that they did, the fact that it looked so nice as it did, is already not so bad, given that the experiment it would be so sensitive to gauge breaking errors, right? Okay, so the upshot is you should care about gauge breaking terms. Okay, any questions up to here? Okay, good. So now, of course, we'll get to how to solve these errors, right? Just a few words. Of course, you can ask, this is a two, you know, double well, is it scalable? And we looked at this. I'm not going to, you know, walk you through the stuff. You can scale it up to 1D chains using two frequency driving, and then you can cook it up and build some crazy lattices. In principle, do 2D lattices. It's not fun. Okay, so that's the upshot. Don't even try it. I think that's the message. All right. But it's, you know, in principle, it's scalable. That's the good news. All right. So I want to talk. So, you know, I told you how to do matter in 1D that's coupling to a gauge field. That's nice. But if you think about the toric code, you all know that there's these plaquette terms, right? They are very important, and they are very nasty, right? Because they're four-body terms, right? And so as soon as you go beyond 1D, you're going to wonder how do we get these plaquette terms, right? And so that's something we also looked at. And so here, I think it's more natural to think about the superconducting qubit platform. So we also looked at how can you build a double well building block for superconducting qubit that gives you this minimal coupling. And it's kind of sketched here. So the idea is, imagine you have these are basically qubits, these C and Ds, and these black ones is also qubits. That's your matter particles. The red one is your, you know, your link variable. And the idea is kind of simple. So you can see the hopping, these blue lines, that's excitations hopping, right? So if you have an excited qubit, it can basically, the excitation can tunnel from here and hop onto here. And the idea is that this intermediate side, this link thing is kind of detuned, you know, off resonant. And so that means if you have a meta excitation, it tunnels into the center, it immediately wants to tunnel out again, right? Because the intermediate energy is so high. And now if you look at these signs here, you can see one of them has a plus G tunneling. All the others are minus G tunnelings. And now the idea is kind of simple. If there's a meta excitation here, it can either tunnel through the upper branch or through the lower branch, right? The hopping sign it picks up is either plus G if it goes here times minus G, so an overall minus, or minus times minus, so an overall plus. And then the idea is that if you have an excitation in the middle, your link qubit, it can block either path, right? So depending on where your link excitation is sitting, it will block the hopping of your meta through the upper or lower branch, and thereby it controls, you know, whether the tunneling has a plus or a minus phase. Don't worry about the details. Let's assume you have such a building block, and you're now going to ask yourself, how can we get these multi-body plaquette charms into the experiment? There's actually a neat way to make this work in a triangular lattice. Maybe again, don't worry too much about the details, but the basic idea is, I want to show you that this works, is the basic idea is to make use, to sort of integrate out the motion of matter such that the motion of matter itself induces these plaquette charms. Okay? So the idea is the matter particles will move around, and we will confine exactly one matter particle for each of these plaquettes. And their motion around these plaquettes, I will show you, actually generate exactly the plaquette term. And in fact, it's a very strong plaquette term. It's as big as the tunneling T here of these matter particles. So if you put this in the perspective of this Fredkin-Schenker phase diagram, where we're sitting is we basically have matter here. And this matter is sort of in a paramagnetic or mod state because we really confine exactly one matter excitation per plaquette. So we're sort of, our goal in the end is to go into this bottom right corner and realize this toric code regime, essentially. OK, and so the trick is essentially, you know, if we look at a single plaquette, it's kind of easy how it works. So you basically, on each link, you have this minimal coupling. So the matter particle is hopping, and it flips these tau z operator when it goes around. And so you can see that when the matter particle is hopping exactly once around this plaquette, of course, it picks up exactly this full string of tau z's, right? The other thing you know is that if you fix this plaquette term here, if you fix the global phase through this plaquette, and you look at the eigenstates of this matter going around, you basically, what you do is you always have your cosine dispersion. It's, you know, essentially periodic boundary conditions on these three sides. And when you have an extra magnetic flux through them, essentially your discrete K momenta, they change a little bit because you have antiperiodic boundary conditions if you have a pi flux. And that means if you have a total plaquette plus one term, your ground state is here. But if you have a plaquette minus one, your ground state is slightly higher, right? Because you put these finite size discrete Ks at these positions of your Ks, and then there, you know, there's an energy gap which is of the order of the tunneling. Or it's exactly the tunneling, actually. And oops, you can actually make this precise. And you know, my student Lucas came up with the unitary transformation. And what it tells you is actually that if you transform your Hamiltonian the right way, your hopping actually looks like this. You have your J particle, the A particle hopping from side J to I. And wherever it hops on this triangle lattice, it always picks up exactly this full plaquette operator. And in this new basis, it's very easy to see that the new eigenstate is actually an exact product state of the matter going around times the links, where the link, degree of freedom should be an eigenstate of your B plaquette in order to, you know, avoid paying exactly this T energy gap. And the cool thing is that this actually works in an extended triangle lattice as well. So you can really show that the ground state of this weird thing here with exactly one matter per plaquette is a state that's exactly a product state of all these localized meta guys times the links. And the links satisfy exactly this plaquette constraint from the toric code on all plaquettes. And the energy gap that protects the state is on the order, it's exactly the tunneling, right? And that means, you know, if you fine-tune your system to make sure this Gauss law is really satisfied, this will the ground state of this is really this toric code ground state. Okay, any questions up to here? All right, good. So you know, this is just to show you that all these different ingredients, like these these gauge invariant meta kinetic energy terms, we can implement those. We can implement these Plaquette terms. But now, you know, we should get more serious about these gauge breaking errors, right? And before I make full use of these errors and how to, you know, avoid them, let me give you like an introduction. And this is not really my work. It's really, it's my postdoc Judd's work. And they looked at ways to protect your system from gauge breaking errors, right? So the basic idea is you have a target gauge sector that you want to realize, and you want to essentially you want to energetically move away all gauge non-invariant states to higher energies, or different energies at least, and make sure that you know when you start dynamics within the sector, you won't go into higher sectors or only perturbatively, right? So that it won't, you know, destroy the gauge invariance in your effective low energy theory. And so I'm, you know, I'll walk you through this, and after that I'll show you how we can actually use this very elegantly to implement these lattice gauge theories also in these Rydberg tweezer arrays. Okay, so I told you already the let's go through the setup, right? We have a Hamiltonian H naught, let's say that's gauge invariant, and then we add a very generic term which is errors, right? So and these errors have a strength lambda, and the idea is that the H naught commutes with our Gauss laws, and the errors don't, right? So that's the simple setup. And the way to think about this is that we can, you know, if this is energy up here and you have different states in your eigenstates essentially of your unperturbed Hamiltonian, they have these good quantum numbers GJ, and then there are these other sectors that have other quantum numbers GJ that we don't want to go to, but then there will be some couplings lambda here, these errors that drive us exactly into these states, and this is very problematic. Once these undesired sectors are energetically degenerate with our target sector, right? Because now the error sort of, you know, can resonantly drive us into the undesired sectors. And once that happens, Fermi's golden rule will immediately tell us, you know, there's a certain rate with which you sort of go into this undesired space, and then you will just, at long times, you will just end up in some average of all these different sectors. And this is true, right? So Judd did numerics on this. You can essentially, the x-axis is time, the y-axis is how much you violate the Gauss law. At short times, you're fine, of course, right? But then at times on the order of, I don't know, depends on the strength of the error, of course, right? But the violation is on the order of one, right? So it's exactly what you expect, right? If you let dynamics happen in such a system, and once you hit a time scale given more or less by this error rate, you're doomed, okay? All right, now the question is how to avoid this, and there's a simple way. And the simple way is to just add a penalty term, right? And essentially that's what happens in toric code, right? In toric code you have these Plaquette terms and the star terms, and essentially both of them commute, that's the beauty, right? The star terms, that's exactly our Gauss law terms, and you just want to make sure that you know, you move excitations that break the star term, you move them energetically to high energies, right? So we can do the same here, we just add a penalty term. And we make sure that this penalty term here also commutes with GJ. And in fact, the simplest strategy is to use for the penalty exactly this difference here, GJ minus GJ target squared, right? And so that means, you know, any time you have a sector, you know, that has not the GJ that you don't want, so here our GJ target is zero, let's say, right? If you think of the zero as a target, just make GJ squared, right? Then you know, you just move all the undesired sectors energetically up. And so this is kind of clear that this works, right? As long as this penalty term is large, any error here will have to overcome this gap. The gap has to be of the order of the penalty V here. And so this will clearly work, right? And I can tell you already now, this is, you know, it works, but it's terrible experimentally, right? Because especially for Z2 lattice gauge theories, these GJs, they have five or so body terms, right? They include many of these link variables and the side variable at the same time. So in theory it works, but it's kind of you know, not so nice. But okay, so again, Judd did numerics and they checked that it works. This is just one example, right? There's time, they look at the violation, and as you expect, as time grows, you know, you actually now saturate, and the larger you make the penalty, like 50, 500 units of this error, you can see that actually, you know, you saturated some finite violation, okay, as expected. You know, the gap just protects it. What's more interesting here, or more non-trivial to guess, is this. So here they looked at the long time behavior, and they varied the error over penalty strength, right? And they can see if the error over penalty is small down here, the basically the long time gauge violation always saturates to some small number. But then once they hit some region around here, so when the error over penalty is on the order of 100, you can see that it starts to be a bit chaotic here, and be, you know, the violation is on the order of 1. And so they basically separate between a controlled violation regime here, and then this is kind of a chaotic regime. You know, you may still be lucky and end up here where it's small, but in general you're doomed essentially. And what this tells you is essentially the penalty method works, but you want to make sure to be in this controlled regime down here. So you want to make sure in practice that your penalty is on the order of 100 or so, you know, of your error strength.
Maybe I missed it. So is the error operator a single site operator or something?
Yeah, good question. So I think in these simulations, yes. They were just looking at single site errors, but they also did simulations with global errors, which I think are less relevant, but you can still have. And you know, it changes the numbers, but the qualitative picture is always the same. Yeah. But if you only have local errors, things in general are nicer, right? That's true. But it, you know, it's not a, yeah. And here, you know, it makes sense that if you have the gap and the gap protects you, it shouldn't really matter whether you have local or non-local. Okay. Good. So now we have to simplify this a little bit, right? Because as I said, these entire G terms we cannot add to the Hamiltonian easily, right? They're just these multibody terms. They're not easily experimentally. And so one thing that Judd and his collaborators worked out is what they call linear gauge protection. This is more for these U1 theories. But essentially, they said, look at this. Let's move all the undesired sectors away in an energy. But it's OK to move some of them up and some of them down. Okay. So you sort of, once you start your dynamics here, you still have an energy gap to go down and an energy gap to go up. And it turns out, these are details. I'll just stick to this picture, okay? It turns out this still works and protects you nicely. If you have errors, you know, they want to go down, you have this energy gap. So there's still some processes that can violate your, that can get you into trouble, right? Which is some higher order decays. So imagine you go, you decay down twice here on two sides, and then another side somewhere away goes up, you would still be resonant, right? So clearly this is not as good as pushing all states up. And that's for this reason, these type of schemes where you single out an intermediate energy sector, they care more about local versus non-local, right? So if you only have local errors and you need these high order processes to happen on multiple sides, then of course you know that's much more unlikely to happen than if you have non-local errors that can actually directly give you these high order decays, right? So now we're in the game of local errors, let's say. And okay, the upshot is, you know, again, they did numerics, again, it works. And qualitatively, again, you get the same picture that there's a controlled error regime down here. And then if your errors are too big, essentially, or your stabilization is too weak, you're still in trouble, okay? All right. So now you have an idea how to protect things against errors. And now I want to move on and show you how we can really make use of this and implement these Z2 lattice gauge theories and this Fredkin-Schenker type model in Rydberg-Tweezer arrays, okay? And you can see the geometry. So we're going to talk about a honeycomb lattice. And the basic setup is like this. So we want Gauss's law, as I described. We want to implement on this honeycomb lattice. And the way to implement this, the way to think about it is like this. So we have link qubits again. That's the red ones. And these will just correspond to Rydberg atoms on these links. Okay, that's the red guys. Empty and filled is Rydberg or ground state. So you know what the qubit state is. And the blues, basically, that's the matter particles. They're on the vertices of the lattice. And again, filled and empty is Rydberg and ground. And you know, red and blue is just for us as theorists to say that they're different. But it's really just both are the same Rydberg and ground atoms, right? So at this point, to get to this here, they just need to take their tweezers and arrange them, right? That's easy for them. They you know, having arbitrary geometries is very easy. So drawing this setup and implementing some qubit configurations, that's easy. All right, now what do we want? Well, if we look at this Gauss law, we have to implement constraints. And the constraints are, well, there are some states here that are GJ size plus states, right? These are the Gauss, we would call them physical states, right? They satisfy the Gauss law. And these are quote unquote unphysical states. So they also satisfy the Gauss law, but with a minus sign. And but no, you know, physical and unphysical, that's just the gauged literature, right? In a quantum simulator, both are, you know, both can exist. It's totally fine. But the idea is our gauge theory, you want to define a subset that only consists of these lower states, right? Okay, and again, the as I said, the problem is exactly that we will have gauge breaking errors that couple these left states to the right states. And we want to avoid them, and so we need a gauge protection scheme. And again, the simplest would be, and that's experimentally hard, but the simplest would be to simply add V times GJ to the Hamiltonian, right? And what it does in an energy, right, it says the physical states have minus V and the unphysical states that we want to remove have plus V energy. So we could split it up like this, and then we would be fine, right? This would work, but the problem is how do you implement this terrible GJ term in a Rydberg array? That sucks, you know. Very, it's, you know, it's five operators, and it's not a simple blockade condition that you can put in. So, right, so these are strong four-body terms. But here's the trick. We're going to go and we're going to allow us one more degree of freedom, which is to cut these unphysical states that we anyway don't care about, right? We're going to cut these into two halves and actually move part of these unphysical states to lower energies. So we're going to make this spectrum locally look like this. So there are some unphysical states that are at a lower energy, some unphysical states over there at higher energy. And all the physical states stay together at intermediate energies. Okay? And it, the only thing we care about is two things. One, that the physical ones stay together. And two, that all the rest is separated by energy gaps that are large. And V is our large, will be our large Rydberg interactions. Okay. Okay. Now, okay, splitting this by hand is easy. But the cool thing is that this splitting this up like this actually works through just two-body interactions. Okay? And they're very simple. So I wrote this term here, but maybe it's even too difficult. I'm just going to walk you through a single vertex, right? So look at one vertex here in the box, and we zoom in, and what we propose to do is simply take a how do you call it, tetrahedron, right? And make sure that all these lines have equal strength interaction. So red with red on these lines here has a 2V interaction strength, and this is 2V, but also the red with the blue has 2V. And of course, in a tetrahedron, all the distances are the same, right? And so with simple 1 over r to the 6 Rydbergs, this would exactly do the job, right? Okay, and you know, if you make a table and translate exactly these simple interactions into which eigenstates you get, you get exactly this, you know, the table from before, essentially this one, right? You get the physical states in the middle at energy V, you get 0 for some of these states, and you get plus 4V for some of the other states. So working this out is not so hard. And the rest of the story here is kind of the same as in this recent Lukin experiments, right? You know, so far, the V is just your Rydberg interaction. And I locally diagonalized and make sure we satisfy this constraint. Next thing you do is you switch on the Rydberg drive. And that tries to flip single qubits, right? So for example, it would take this red, blue one here, flip it, and go over to this one, right? And so what you actually start doing is you couple these physical to these unphysical sectors. Now you would say, you know, that's a perturbation. You don't really want that. But of course, as long as your V, your stabilization is big enough, that's OK if you just do it perturbatively, right? You go there and you'll go back. But then if you go back, you can actually, you know, go from here to here and then maybe go to another state, right? So essentially, higher orders in this drive will give you some interesting dynamics within this intermediate energy sector. And as long as your drive omega here on these individual qubits is weak, you're guaranteed to stay within this Z2 gauge invariant subspace. And OK, so then my student did this calculation of the effective Hamiltonian. How does the effective Hamiltonian look like? It's in principle, it's just perturbation theory. And you get a bunch of terms. I'm just, you know, I'll draw pictures for these. First is hopping. So if you have a Z2 charge here, it can tunnel. And as it tunnels, it drags the string along. We can see that here. You will get pairing terms. So you can basically annihilate two metaparticles and flip a string in between. You will get, we call them anomalous pairing terms. It's almost the same, except the sign of the pairing term here will depend on whether there is a string between these guys or not. It's a weird type of term, but it's gauge invariant. So it can happen. Then we have the Plaquette terms here, and they obviously flip the entire Plaquette. And we have the chemical potential and this confining term from before. Okay, so long story short, in these Rubik tweezer arrays with just the two-body interactions, it's kind of actually natural to realize such type of ledge gauge theories with dynamical matter and in 2D, right? And so the question we sort of started sketching out in the project was, how does the phase diagram look like?
Yeah. The last two terms there, they don't violate the gauge.
Yeah, right, they don't, right? Because it's tau x is exactly the electric field that anyway shows up in G. And the same is true for the matter, right? It's just a matter, yeah. Right. And so they just shift your overall energies. Right. And so, you know, we started looking at what types of physics do we expect in these phase diagrams. And one thing is interesting, if you switch off these pairing terms completely, and you can do that by changing, you know, your chemical potentials, you can make sure your system also conserves the total particle number, then you have a global U1 symmetry. So this is a model that goes, that's, you know, different from this standard Fredkin-Schenker because your global particle number is conserved. So now if you, on your pure gauge axis here, you still have the toric code phase here if you have no matter at all. But it's interesting that once you include any matter, right, excitations, that's this regime here, the pure matter axis, that would give you a superfluid. But then when you have a superfluid, that cannot sustain any topological order. Because these guys, it's like in a Higgs phase, right? These guys are Z2 charged, so you cannot have topological order. So the toric code is really only exists when you have a complete vacuum of your matter particles. But then if you, there can be another interesting phase, a meson condensate essentially, when these Z2 charges are confined and form pairs. And those pairs then have an emergent U1 symmetry. These can condense again, right? So that's something that could show up here. And then there's, if you fully fill the thing up with one matter excitation per site, then you also have an odd Z2 lattice gauge theory. So that's kind of the, it's, you know, similar to what happens in the vacuum case, except it's more interesting because you know, the Gauss, you turned around the sign of your Gauss law. And okay, there's a question mark. There are more things that could happen. So, you know, we're looking into this now numerically, but it's kind of hard, right? So we hope experiments will also help us shed more light onto this phase diagram. Especially if you have any non-integer filling of with matter. People don't really know exactly what's going on. But then you can switch on the pairing terms. If you just have this first pairing term, the symmetry is as in Fredkin-Schenker. So essentially, we expect this Fredkin-Schenker-like case, you know, with toric code here. We don't know exactly what happens if you switch on this anomalous terming, the pairing term. Symmetry is the same, though. So we think qualitatively it should look like in Fredkin-Schenker. Quantitatively, we don't know. And last thing I want to mention is that you
no exact mapping in that case.
No, even yeah.
Theory, like a classical theory.
No, we didn't find any. So the Fredkin-Schenker one actually only works even if this delta one is equal to t, I think. Then it works, and then you have exact mapping. If you have delta one not equal to t, we still think it's pretty clear that it's, you know, symmetries are the same as in Fredkin-Schenker. But even their details can, you know, change.
So if you go back one.
Yeah.
And you're on the
this one?
H theory axis there.
Uh-huh.
So that confinement, deconfinement transition, that's in the 3D.
Yep. Yes.
Classical equivalent, but you don't have that equivalent? Or oh no, because your delta one term is zero. So
yeah, here we're fine, right? If in the vacuum, if you don't have any matter at all, it's the pure toric code. That's easy and clear. And I guess, so that same is true here, right? If you're completely on vacuum, that's fine. But as soon as you go up, I mean, I'm sure in terms of symmetries, it's still the same, right? But there's no clear mapping. And that's why we call it sort of quantum, also with these anomalous terming, pairing terms, we call it quantum Z2 meta, right? Because it's, you know, maybe there's still a sign problem free way of solving it at least, but there's no clear mapping to a purely classical theory that we know of. Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, maybe the last thing I want to emphasize here is that you can also explore things like these the quantum dimer models. So far, I focus on this intermediate state set of states, right, that satisfy the Z2 Gauss law. But if you go to the ground state manifold, that realizes an effective dimer model, right? And you can do the same story and, you know, derive some Plaquette terms and some valence bond, you know, favoring terms here. So it's, you know, the upshot is there's a huge playground that you can do once you implement all these constraints. Yeah, maybe I'll just close by mentioning two things we thought about that would be worth also exploring in these experiments. And one thing, of course, is ground state physics, but you need to do these adiabatic ramps and so on. That's not a fun thing. It takes time. And so dynamics can be cool. So one idea is to explore things like disorder free localization. And that's a kind of a funny idea where you initialize your system in a gauge non-invariant state. And then essentially by, you know, that means the Gauss laws, they're not well defined. You can be in a superposition of having plus one and minus one Gauss laws. And this will actually generate you disorder in your system and without having any actual disorder. And then you can see that if you start with some charge density wave configuration here, in a gauge non-invariant state, the red line, you can see it goes to some plateau at long times. Whereas if you start in a gauge invariant state, there's no self-generated disorder, you go to zero, right? So that's one thing one can explore. And the other thing I'm very excited about is looking at confinement in these systems, right? So a simple thing is you can look at just two charges and tune temperature, right? Just take two charges in this gauge theory, tune their temperature. And the idea is that if you just take two charges and you separate them, it's not only the positions of the charges, but it's also the configuration of the string that connects them that you have to include. And that means you have a large entropic contribution. And this means that at some critical temperature, entropy can actually take over and you get a finite temperature deconfinement transition. And you know, we check this numerically in a classical limit. But so you know, we expect that if you increase temperature in these systems, you should also see confinement deconfinement type of transitions. I think this is a you know fun way of looking at confinement deconfinement in these quantum systems.
Sorry, that's dimensionality dependent, right?
Yeah, that should be. I agree. Yes.
And you were in 2D.
So right. So
you saw a finite temperature transition here. Is that what you're saying?
So the we did an approximation here, which is we ignored the hopping of the matter, and then you have a classical theory in 2D, and there you get a finite temperature transition. And we also expect once you include quantum fluctuations, it may change. But that would be interesting to explore. I think it's not entirely clear how exactly it would change. Yeah. All right. No, I think time is up, so I'm just going to skip through the summary. There's also some things you can play with, antiferromagnets and map them onto lattice gauge theories. I didn't talk about that, but I think the upshot is I think these Rydberg Twiese arrays are a fun platform to explore, you know, lattice gauge theory physics, and it's a great playground for theorists, to have more new numerically challenging models that hopefully experiments will add some experimental insights to, and many interesting theoretical things we can look at, and I'm in particular interested in this confinement deconfinement. Looking at this from a real space perspective, I think this will help solve this challenging problem. Yeah, thanks a lot for your attention.
Questions? So could you go back to the phase diagram?
Let's see.
The one with U.S. symmetry.
Yeah. So I suppose this one. We'll be right there. Right.
So just try to understand. So on the bottom of the phase diagram, there's a confined phase and deconfined phase.
Yeah.
And then you increase mu, you get this mass on condensate.
Mm-hmm.
There, do you have U1 symmetry? Or,
yeah.
U1 symmetry spontaneous break.
That's right. Yeah, that's the idea. Right, but it's
spontaneous break. Okay.
In the condensate, it would be, right?
Okay, I see.
Uh huh.
So then, what's the difference between this mass on condensate and superfluid?
So in the superfluid, you actually have the U1 symmetry, right? And here it's broken.
No, superfluid means you break U1.
Right, but it's kind of hard once you couple it to the matter, right?
No,
it's the Higgs phase.
Confused. Because U1 is a global symmetry, right?
Right. But that's also in the Fredkin-Schenker, right? If you look at the long-range ferromagnetic phase, then and you connect it to this confining phase, it's all the same trivial phase, right?
Well, there you only have global Z2 symmetry. Then the Z2, there you don't have any global symmetry because the Z2 is gauged. So then Right. Doesn't have to breaking at all. There.
Right, but I think
here you have a barely finding your one, so then you can ask whether you are in spontaneous break or not.
But I think it's the same, right? Because you also you partly gauge the global U1, right? You know, it's mod Z2.
You just redefine your quantization condition for the U1 symmetry. You don't really, I mean, U1 is still there.
Yeah, but I mean, isn't that the same for Z2? Like if you...
No, Z2, once you gauge it, there's nothing left.
Yeah.
But U1, if you just gauge its Z2 subgroup, then you still get U1, just a coin charge 1, the original charge 1. Original charge 2 pi.
Yes.
Right.
So, wait, what? But then what does it mean, right? Because I think this here should be when you really, you know, what happens here is that you condense something that does not carry any U1 charge, right? So that should be different from what happens in the superfluid, right? Here, because there you have, you know, your charge carriers do carry the Z2 charge. So we think that this, you know, should be a Higgs phase then, and this is a
Higgs phase.
This is a more trivial one, right? But so that, okay, I think okay, this is an interesting discussion. What this question mark means, right?
Yeah.
I would love to understand this better too.
So you did numerics on this model?
No. We discussed with some of Subir's people, and you know maybe there's some numerics one can do, but it's very hard, right?
With so then like, how do you get this step?
Oh, it's just I mean the limits. The vacuum limit is clear, and this limit here is you know it's clear as an odd. And here we just looked at limiting cases, right? If you're strongly confined, it's clear that you forget everything about your lattice gauge theory, right?
Yeah.
So that's all we did, right? And the pure meta axis here is all also clear. And that's what the question mark tells us, you know, there may be more stuff in between.
I see.
Right.
So in the language of field theory, superfluid is really just you have this matter field condensed. That's what you call Higgs phase, right?
Yes.
So then there you should break both the U1 global symmetry and Z2 gauge symmetry.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
And then for this Metzger condensate, you don't explicitly condense the matter field, but you're just saying that the gauge field is confined.
Yeah.
And then you get those mesons and mesons condense.
Yeah, I think the way we look at coming from here is we say exactly that you have the mesons, they're confined. Then you also have a global U1 symmetry which conserves the meson number.
Yeah.
And then you break this global U1, but it's not exactly the same as the overall global U1.
Yeah, in the description of the field theory, it's not the same, but I would guess.
Yeah.
They're the same phase.
Yeah, I.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know that's the motivation also to understand these things better. Yeah.
Other questions? I would. That's all.
Yeah. So in the middle of the talk, you were talking about like penalty term in your I thought like penalty terms are used like when you want to encode constraints in a Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
Why did you need that penalty term again?
Oh, it's exactly doing what you said, right? Because the constraint you want is that G on psi is 1, right? And so you add something like minus V times G. So whenever your G is not 1, you pay V, right?
Okay.
So that really enforces your penalty, you know, your constraint.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we can continue in the bistro over lunch. Let's thank Fabian again for great.
Thanks, guys.